Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm John Kendall.
And I'm Kendall Stormo.
No relation.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for the show is beg, borrow, or steal. We'll hear stories of moxie, ingenuity, and desperation.
Our first storyteller this hour comes from West Anchorage High School. Sophomore Jessica Yang tells a tale that anyone with siblings can relate to. Here's Jessica on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So all throughout my life, my mother had constantly told me, treat your sisters well, because at some point in your life, they may be the only people you have left with you. And I more or less understood the general lesson she was getting at with this, which is basically treat them well, don't exploit them, you know, share with them, and just live in general harmony with them. But I never really understood the entirety of her lesson. And this sister she was referring to is Lillian, who is 3 years younger than me and more or less looks exactly like me, leading many people in our elementary school days to call her a miniature Jessica because of our physical resemblance. And currently right now, though, she's the same height as me, so most people call us twins. And my relationship with her can basically be described as, I just didn't really want a sister. I wanted to be an only child. I didn't really want anyone I had to, like, share things with, and I just wanted to get everything, all the best things. And to me, to be honest, she was more competition for resources rather than someone I could live in harmony with. So, yeah, and I was also rather bossy to her when we were younger. I kind of exploited that I was older than her and kind of used that to force her to do things with me. Like, I remember how when I was really young, I would get lonely using the bathroom, so I would have her come sit by me, and she would accompany me. And my attitude towards her can basically be summarized by the first thing I said when I saw her in the hospital when I was 3 years old, which was, let's throw her in the trash can. And, yeah. But this all changed one day in ninth grade when I came home to Lillian yelling at Grace, my second youngest sister, for stealing her stuffed animals. And I had been assigned so many projects that day and was already extremely stressed and just wanted, you know, like quiet time at home. And so I stormed upstairs to Lillian's room to yell at her for yelling at Grace. Ironic, I know. And to the point of making her cry. And right when I was about to calm down from my anger, I turned around when suddenly I heard her mutter something about how I had no authority in her room, and that did not sit too well with me. And so I turned around, and in the fit of my rage, I slammed her door so hard that I broke it off its hinges. And I remember just staring at that broken door with complete shock on my face because I had ripped it clean off the top two hinges and the door was only connected to the wall by the last hinge. And I remember just like feeling fear just go through me at the thought of like when my parents came back to see just this disaster here. And so I turned over to Lillian, who was also like staring with like shock etched on her face, like tears still streaming down at her door. And just waited for the blow to fall, for her to say, Jessica, you are in so much trouble when mom and dad come back. And laughing gleefully, too, because I would be getting in trouble. But she never did. Instead, she said, we will be in so much trouble when mom and dad come back. And that we took me by complete surprise, because this entire situation, from the broken door to her tears, was entirely my fault, and she could easily escape all blame simply by telling the truth. And so I was like, okay, someone to share the blame with, why not? I'm just gonna roll with it. So I went and ordered her to grab me some screws and a hammer, and she spent the next hour helping me fix her door that I had broken. And we managed to fix it, so at least it looked normal and it was like on the wall again, but like we sort of forgot about it at as the day went on, until that evening when my mom, Lillian, and I were playing a game of cards in Lillian's room. And my mom was kind of sitting with her back towards the door. And like I said before, by that time, we had sort of forgotten about the door, like totally, you know, just like, yeah. But like an hour went by and nothing seemed to go wrong with the door. Like, you know, it was still like on the wall until I managed to glance over an hour in and realize that the door had fallen off the two top hinges and was hanging on its last hinge due to my mom's weight. And I just remember just feeling dread overcome me again, as you would imagine, and just total fear that my mom was going to turn around and see the broken door behind her. And so I turned towards Lillian and kind of motioned at her with my eyes, like, look at the door behind Mom. And she did, and she looked back at me. And we just exchanged this shared sense of fear that my mom was going to see that door behind her. And my mom sort of felt the atmosphere change in the room a little bit at that moment. And so she kind of looked at us and then turned around, looked behind her, looked at the door, and then looked back at us and asked, what are you guys looking at? And at that point, me and Lillian just broke out into uncontrollable laughter because my mom has looked at the door and hadn't even seen it. And so it took a few minutes for us to calm down enough to kind of like recollect ourselves. And by that time, Lillian started ushering my mom out the door, kind of giving me a, like a knowing smile to like fix the door, which I tried. But luckily, luck was on our side that day because we had a couple 5 and 6-year-olds over at our house. And we kind of just pushed the blame onto them about the broken door. And my parents never found out that I broke the door until now. And I remember just that evening where I was laying in bed just thinking about the entire situation and realizing how throughout my entire life, Lillian had always been on my side, no matter the circumstances, and I had just never appreciated having her enough. Like, I had never realized how much I appreciated having a sister I could always depend on to have my back, someone I could always talk to, someone I could share secrets with, and just like someone I knew who would always be there for me. And when I was laying in bed, something about my mom's statement about how sisters are your best friends that will be with you forever, even while, like when some of your other friends may leave you, something about that just clicked with me, and I realized how I probably couldn't live as well as I do without Lily in my life. And the event that truly cemented this was when I went to New York that summer for a month just by myself. And at first, I was so excited because I was like, oh, without Lily in a month, great, wonderful. And then I realized about a week in that I actually missed Lillian, just someone I could talk to. And I remember being so emotional after coming back after New York after a month that the night I came back, I remember trying to kiss Lillian goodnight just because I was so emotional at seeing her again. And but the last second, I was like, no, Jessica, you can't do that. That's not you. That's too cheesy. So I never did. But I'll never forget that moment where I realized how I would not give up Lillian for anything in the world. And maybe throwing Lillian in the trash can wouldn't necessarily have been the best idea. Thank you.
That was a story from Jessica Yang, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. We're hearing Alaskans tell short 7-minute stories about their lives.
Up next, we have a unique story from Alaska-born and raised Kate Bragg. This one is called Placenta Tree.
So to celebrate my 30th birthday, I decided to do 30 things in my 30th year that I had never done. 30 things is a lot for 1 year. So coming up with this list with my family, my parents, and my sister Erin just before my 30th birthday, we were kind of humming hawing over things, and my dad says to me, well, why don't you plant that damn placenta of yours? And everyone in my family, we laughed hilarity like we do always at placenta stories in my family. And I said, you know what, Dad, that's a good idea, because who in this world can say they've planted their own placenta? That's right, not one that came out of me, because that's never happened, but one that came out after me. So I was born in February, the dead of winter in Alaska here at Humana Hospital, 2 years after my sister. So my parents, being the hippies they were like, oh yeah, we got this, you know, we're gonna plant her placenta just like we did her sister's. And so on the way home from the hospital, they brought me and my placenta. And When they got home, my dad went to the garage and got out his vacuum sealer, like every good fisherman does. And he vacuum sealed that placenta, put it in a plastic Cars bag, and then with a black Sharpie in block lettering, wrote the word placenta across that plastic bag, half tied it, tossed it in the freezer, and went inside to figure out what life was going to be like with three women. So springtime came around, and my dad's out there in the yard, you know, tending to my sister's two-year-old placenta tree. We've got the chicken wire around it so the moose don't eat it. And as you can imagine, life with two toddlers is just a little bit too busy to remember about the placenta in the freezer. So it got forgotten, and it got forgotten again and again and again. And so I grew up with my placenta in the freezer. You can imagine what a sleepover is like in seventh grade when you're at a new school and you're trying to make friends and you're like, hey, come sleep over. Oh yeah, let's get ice cream. And so you run out to the freezer and you whip it open and like block lettering placenta and your friends are like, please tell me that's from a caribou. And you're like, no, it's mine. Don't worry about it. Let's just get the mint chocolate chip. And luckily those are still my friends today. I continued to grow up watching my sister's placenta tree grow in our front yard. And, you know, I hate the heat, so it kind of makes sense. She loves the earth. She's got a tree. I lived in the freezer. When I was in high school, it was time for my family to move out of state to pursue our ski racing. And we're moving. It's August. My dad's going through the freezer, and he's like, Gail, what are we going to do with all this fish in case placenta? And my mom's like, oh, don't worry, I'll take it to Annie Corey's. That's her younger sister. So sure enough, she does. She takes it up there, and she's like, hey, Corey, can you plant case placenta? We never got around to it, so maybe just do it next spring or something. And she says, yeah, of course. No, I'm not doing that. So she, like, tosses it in her freezer. I'm still wondering to this day why no one threw it out. I guess emotional attachment is a thing. So my placenta lived in my aunt's freezer for another 15 years. And it sat there pretty much forgotten, except for when my aunt wanted to threaten my cousins with placenta spaghetti for dinner. So they pretty much never misbehaved. So when I moved back to the state, just before my 30th birthday, came up with this list. And I said, yeah, Dad, I'm gonna plant my placenta. So in May of my 30th year, I was a new homeowner, planning my yard, kind of like, oh, what am I gonna put in my garden? My aunt at her house has some raspberry bushes that came from my parents' house, where my sister's placenta tree is still thriving. And don't worry, we've been looking at it on Google Earth from time to time when we lived out of the state. I'm pretty sure that the placenta tree made the toast in my dad's wedding, from my dad at my sister's wedding. I don't think I made the toast. I think just my sister's placenta tree did. So yeah, I'm basically like a third child. Anyway, springtime, my 30th year, I'm like getting ready for this planting that's culminating my whole life. So I go to Bell's Nursery. Well, first I think I'm gonna plant it with some raspberries because I'm like, that'll be great. And then my friends were like, oh, we will never eat anything out of your garden if you do that. And so I was like, well, I guess I kind of want to keep you guys as friends, so fine. So I went to Bell's Nursery and I was like, oh, this is a nice bleeding heart start. I'm gonna get this. So I got my bleeding heart start, cruised on over to Annie Corey's, and I was like, hey, can I get that placenta off your hands? She was like, gladly. So I'm 30 now, right? I realize I've never looked inside that plastic bag that says placenta. And I'm thinking like 30 years freezer burn, like nothing. I don't work in the medical industry, so I've never seen organs or any of that stuff. So I'm literally like, this is like throwing an ice cube in the ground. It won't be that difficult. So I asked my aunt, she's never looked in the bag. So we decide to open the bag. We open it up. I pull out that vacuum seal. Dude, solid block of red. Like, I know a guy if you need someone to vacuum seal your fish. This thing had no freezer burn at all. So I take it home and I'm like, well, it's gonna smell. Like, it's definitely gonna smell when I thought it ain't thawing in my kitchen sink. So I put it in a Home Depot, one of those orange Home Depot buckets in my garage. And I think I got some chopsticks because I was like, oh, I can like take chopsticks, put it in the hole in the ground. Some rubber gloves, because like obviously I'm not touching that. So I went to bed. I woke up the next morning. I was like, okay, it's definitely thawed. So I like opened the garage door. I'm like, no smell. Weird. Okay, it's not alive, so that's good. So I go out. I've got my bleeding heart start. I dug my hole, and I finally opened that plastic bag one last time. And with my rubber glove, I'm expecting full leakage right from the vacuum, 30-year vacuum seal. And I pick it up, and it's kind of like, you know, in college when you played slap the bag with a box of wine? Like that's what it looked like. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm thoroughly grossed out. So use those scissors, flopped all its goodness into that hole. I kind of like poked it a little bit, took some photos for mom. Put that bleeding heart start on top. Stood back, admired my work. I was like, yeah, planted my own placenta. Called my sister and I said, hey, next time you're looking at your thriving placenta tree on Google Earth, fly on over to my house and check out my placenta bush because it's thriving.
And there you have it, Kate Bragg's story of one woman planting her own placenta 30 years after the fact.
You're listening to Arctic Entries Radio. Today we're hearing stories of moxie, ingenuity, and desperation.
Up next, we have a heart-wrenching recollection from Elizabeth Meredith. Here she is sharing her story in front of a live audience of 700 people on the Discovery Theater at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So in the 1990s, my life became a cautionary tale. That was a time when if a person was in an abusive relationship, people felt free to say things like, why do you put up with that? I never would. Why do you stay? And yet I didn't. I had no idea what would happen later. But let me rewind. In 1990, in March particularly, I was 25 years old, married. My husband was verbally abusive, and I had two beautiful little girls under the age of 3. I thought I could manage the relationship. Insults, okay. But it became more controlling, more isolating, and in March 5th, actually, of 1990, he strangled me around the neck in front of my oldest child while she was screaming. And that was when I knew that I had to get out. Eventually, I got my daughters together and made my way to the AWAKE shelter, Abused Women's Aid in Crisis, the Battered Women's Shelter here in town. And there, we had some safety and time for me to figure out how to create a new future for us. It would be a lot of work. Fast forward 2 years, I had completed the degree in journalism that I started when I was young, so that was good. The girls were older. We were off every kind of assistance we had relied on in those interim years. So off public assistance, housing assistance, legal assistance. I still got daycare assistance, and that was fabulous. And I worked a terrific job at AWAKE, the same place that I went to for safety with the girls. The girls were a little older. It was a great time. Living large on $10 an hour and just really embracing the fact that we were going for our beautiful future. We deserved our own happily ever after. So I noticed that, well, I didn't notice closely enough, but we were doing well, except for the more I focused on our future and having a happily ever after, the harder my former husband focused on destroying me. And often he did that by using our daughters. So much so, in fact, that we decided to have, or rather I decided, we would have pickup and drop off from visits at the daycare, their fabulous daycare at Faith Daycare and Learning Center. That way we could avoid kind of bad language and things like that, scariness in front of the kids during pickup, drop off. One day in 1994, so that's 4 years after I left, in March again, March 13th of 1994, I'm getting off work at AWAKE, drove to the daycare to pick up my daughters, who were now 4 and 6 years old and cute as buttons, and they weren't at the daycare. They weren't at the daycare. They weren't in the city of Anchorage. They weren't in Alaska, in the United States. They were in my former husband's home country of Greece. He had kidnapped our daughters, taken them against court order, and disappeared to go to Greece. That was everything I had, all of my hopes in them. the greatest connection I will have ever had in my little daughters, and they were living out a consequence because I left. It would take 2 years before I saw my daughters again. 2 years, a ton, a legion of support. Friends, coworkers, strangers in Anchorage, people even in Greece who supported my effort so that I could reunite with my daughters. 2 years later, in March again, of 1996, I was reunited with my daughters in the country of Greece. Before we had our first meeting, I rehearsed a little bit. I wondered, what have the girls been through, and do they even speak English anymore? So I learned to say some things in Greek so that we could connect. Things like, I love you, sagapo, and I've been looking for you. I can't remember how I used to say that, but I rehearsed it so that I wouldn't scare them as much and so that they could be reassured. When we first saw each other, my youngest daughter, who was now turning 7 years old, looked like she'd seen a ghost. It was terrifying for her to see me. Later, I would find out that she thought she had seen a ghost. She was told that I was dead. My oldest daughter was excited at first, but that quickly turned to tears. She was afraid of retribution from what would happen when her dad found out I was in Greece. They didn't speak my language. They didn't speak English anymore. But soon, they started picking up language, as children do. They were quick learners, and so they had a lot to say. Things like, Mommy, you have a lot of crinkles around your eyes now. Mommy, your butt fell down. Or, Mommy, why are our poster hanging up in Walmart? Their missing children's poster was there still for a while after they came home. So they picked up some language. And then I enrolled them in therapy, got them in a great school at Polaris, and we had a wonderful supportive community. They went into sports. Within 6 months, you'd have never known something bad happened to them. They were doing amazing, and it was important to me that they were doing well. I insisted on it because I thought a couple of things. One, I assumed they were a reflection of me as their mother. Two, I thought that our donors, the people that had helped us, deserved them to do well as a thank you. And I put that pressure on them. And at first, that went really fine. Until later, as they got older, there started to be cracks that developed in their little psyches. The thing about trauma is, if it doesn't have an outlet, if there isn't enough support and healing, it just gets stuck in our bodies. And so behaviorally, mental health-wise, physical health-wise, it changes us. And for my daughters, it was still there. It was still there under all that pressure. The thing is that when they were kidnapped, they were taken from the parent that loved them, the community that supported them. They were taken away from their language, their foods, their friends, and planted in Greece and expected to do beautifully immediately, to just act like nothing happened. And then 2 years later, I show up. And although I have the best of intentions then, I do the same thing. I take them from the parent, their friends, their routine, their school, their language, their food, and bring them to America expecting that they would just do all right and act as though nothing horrible had happened. And it had. Now it was my turn to go to therapy. I needed to learn the language that they spoke. I needed to learn the language of trauma. I learned through the process to accept my children as they are. They are not extensions of me. And we wouldn't live life unscathed, but I did learn it was fabulous to be together. And it was enough for us to speak the same language and for us to live our happily enough ever after. Thank you.
That was Lisbeth Meredith, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our theme is Beg, Borrow, or Steal, stories of moxie, ingenuity, and desperation.
Our next story contains mature content, including descriptions of sexual assault. It is not suitable for children, but it's a powerful and important story nonetheless. For those of you who would like to sit this one out, we'll give you a second to turn down the volume or hit fast forward. And here is Linda Wayford.
In 1989, a pregnant woman in Wasilla was raped by her physician during a pelvic exam. I found out about that rape 2 years later while working as a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. I also learned that this doctor had raped at least 5 other women. All of them had been either pregnant or infertile. I felt it was important to do a story. Even though the doctor had confessed to the crimes, the public was struggling to believe it. I approached my editor at the Anchorage Daily News and asked him if I could do an investigative piece on this doctor. And he said, yes. I contacted some of the victims and asked them if I could interview them for the story. And they said, yes. But I want to back up a minute. I wanted to do this story because, not only because I was a journalist, I felt it was a story that had to be told. There was a personal reason as well. I had to do it both as a woman and a young mother. And here's why. The accused doctor had shared a medical office in Anchorage with the physician who had recently delivered my daughter. Also, when I was a 20-year-old college student, my optometrist suggested that the reason my new contacts were hurting my eyes was because I had a cold. I didn't have a cold. Well, he slipped his hand under my shirt, beneath my bra, and massaged my breasts. "I'm feeling for swollen lymph nodes," he told me. Alarm bells went off inside my head, but another part of my brain said, "Well, this must be normal. He's well known in the community. He's a medical professional. My gosh, his wife is seated at the reception desk just outside the door." So I met with one of the victims, her name was Rhonda, at the Flying Dutchman restaurant. When we first met, her hands were clenched on her lap. Her voice was broken at times. And I was surprised when she asked me if, for my story, I would publish her name and photograph so that it might lend credibility to a seemingly unbelievable story. How could this esteemed physician, who often prayed with his patients, turn his patients into prey? While talking to Rhonda, I kept asking her, how did it happen? How did he do this? And I remember how she fixed her gaze on me long and hard, and she said, please tell me that you do believe me. And I thought, here I am, a general assignment reporter, trying to get this gracious woman to relive the trauma of her rape. And I tried to do better. Rhonda and I met a number of times after that, and I met with some of the other victims as well, who asked that I only refer to them in the story by their initials. Over time, a pattern emerged as to how this doctor had gotten away with his assaults. He used his reputation as the chief of staff of obstetrics and gynecology at what was then Alaska's largest hospital. He also used his wholesome and religious persona. He performed long pelvic exams on the women so that he could desensitize them and so that they might not notice it when he removed his fingers and he inserted his penis. And he prevented them from seeing the rape occur with a sheet that was draped over their knees that were drawn up on the exam table. The night before my big story was to come out, my editor called me at home several times, ensuring that every fact was accurate, every word was spelled correctly, every name. And then, on February 2nd, 1992, my story went viral before there even was such thing as viral. People called from all over the country, including two women who told me that they too had been raped by this doctor years before. National news outlets picked up the story, and so did some magazines. Suddenly, it seemed everyone knew his name, Dr. Ake. The day Dr. Ake was sentenced for his crimes, I sat in the back of a courtroom and I watched Rhonda shake her head in disbelief when the judge sentenced him to 6 years in prison for a serial rapist. Public outrage then increased the sentence to 8 years in prison, again, for a serial rapist. I've stayed in touch with Rhonda for many years, and I thought of her recently when Dr. Larry Nassar was in the news, and how he sexually assaulted the members of the U.S. gymnastics team. I thought about Rhonda and that flash of anguish in her eyes when we met at the Flying Dutchman and she thought I didn't remember her. I thought about all of Dr. Ake's victims and wondered if their anger and their pain resurfaced when they heard what Dr. Nassar did to those trusting girls laid out on his examination table. Rhonda, I'm still in touch with her. The lump that she found on her breast turned out to be breast cancer that had spread largely, she believes, because she had waited because she was afraid to return to a doctor to be examined. Tonight, I stand here with Rhonda, and I stand here with DR and IS and MD and all the other women. And I am with them when they raise their arm and they say, "Me too." Thank you.
That was Linda Wafer telling her story for Arctic Entries. In case you hear a story you'd like to share with a friend, all the past Arctic Entry stories are available for listening at arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud. You can listen to this show in its entirety at alaskapublic.org.
Our theme today is Beg, Borrow, or Steal. So far, we've heard stories of sibling squabbles, a woman burying her placenta in her backyard, horrific family trauma, and women coming together to stand up for justice. Now it's time for a lighter note. To give us a little parenting advice, here's a tale from Catherine Ormberg.
Back in 1994, I attended my husband's family reunion, and there were a ton of kids there, all ages, and this was before we had children. And I looked at all the kids around, and I thought, what a show. I want absolutely nothing to do with that. I'm going to have a different kind of family. I'm going to have kids that don't fight, they don't argue with me, they don't lip off, they don't kick and scream, and they're not going to be eating sugar and high fructose corn syrup. And then, in 1995, I had my first child. Now, this story could have been about a lot of different things because I have three children. I considered talking about the disadvantages of cloth diapers and washing your own, that it is possible to have a husband that can't handle cloth diapers and rinsing them out in the toilet, and in fact, may retch so hard that he pulls his back out. I thought about talking about the parents that blah, 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 how great their kids are and mine aren't, and how irritating that is. And I thought about talking about my kids when they were 3 and 4 and how they got a hold of a church microphone and told their poopy butt fart stories until someone finally stopped them. But that's nothing that you can really take home, that you can use. And I wanted to send you off with a little nugget to put in your pocket. So I thought I'd talk about my child-rearing motto. And it goes like this. If you're not having fun, then why are you doing it? By God, one way or another, I'm going to have fun, no matter what's happening, because life is hard enough, and when you have kid issues, you don't need it. I came to this motto years ago when I was working in a doctor's office, and the physician said, you know, I've got this 16-year-old daughter. She's, I don't know what to do. She's smoking. And I've told her the long-term effects. I've bribed her. I've cried. I've carried on. And nothing. And I said, well, you've got to fight fire with fire. You've got to do what she's doing, but do it better. You have to start smoking heavily. He's like, I don't get it. Yeah, I said, here's what you do. You light up around her friends. You ask them for a light. And then you go on and on about how wrong you were. That, yeah, you do feel cooler. You are cool now that you're smoking. And he's like, that, whatever. Week later, problem solved. She said, Dad, you look like an idiot. If you stop smoking, I'll stop smoking. Flash forward, my daughter's in 7th grade. And, you know, things are going pretty well. I say pretty well because, you know, it's never great. So she comes home and randomly, just randomly, starts lying. Lie. Lying about everything. Things she didn't need to lie about. Who she had lunch with, what she ate for lunch, who her teachers, what they said that day. I'm like, Colleen, honey, why are you lying?
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay, that's weird. Honey, lying is a sin. You are either going to go to purgatory or maybe hell. And you're changing the relationship with your mother, and it's so hurtful. I begged, I pleaded, I bribed, to no avail. Randomly, I found myself in my closet with a large goblet of wine. And I was crying. And I thought, this is spiraling out of control. And then I remembered, I'm not having fun. So I did what any good mother would do. I started lying. I lied about everything. Honey, you know that chicken salad you like so much? I packed a big bunch. It's in your lunch, and you can share it with your friends. No, just 2 dirty apples. Honey, you know that dress you saw online for the dance? I got it for you. It was really expensive, but you're worth it. There's no dress. What? You're ready to be picked up at school? You're sitting out on the sidewalk and you're cold? Oh, honey, I'm almost there. No. Eventually, after many nights of me dreaming about lies, she came to me and said, I can't take it anymore. Please. So we both stopped lying. A few years later, high school shows up. I get a call from the school. Your daughter's dressed inappropriately. Not possible. She left in boots, coat, hat, jeans. It's not what she's wearing right now. She's wearing really tight yoga pants and a blouse that is very low cut. You need to come and do something about this. Well, at first I'm like, my God, my daughter is dressing like a slut. And then I remembered. Shh. short, tight dress, tight, lacy tights, and 8-inch heels, and I show up at school. Hello, Colleen's mommy's here to drop off some things for her. Here you go, honey. I look around the classroom. Priceless. I didn't get that call again. 2 weeks ago, my son, 16, shows up home from school. He bought himself a vape. I'm like, oh, all right. Can I see it? All right. So I hold it. I turn it over in my hand a few times. And I take the longest drag off of a vape that's ever been done. Now, I have asthma. My chest became like a drum, super tight, hurt. I'm wheezing, I'm coughing, I can't catch my breath. He's running around the house. Where's your inhaler? Where's your inhaler? Finally, things settle down. I sit down. I said, Sean, I want you to know, I think you've made a good choice. I think you're really gonna enjoy this vape. He said, you know what? You ruined it. Thanks a lot. And he threw it in the garbage. And I said, yeah, but you didn't notice that I was still having fun. Thank you.
That was Catherine Ornberg, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage.
As many Alaskans know, you can plan all you can for a hike, but there's still some things you just can't prepare for. To tell our story of an unexpected hiking snafu, this is Charlotte Foley.
My family wasn't exactly thrilled about my plan to move to Anchorage in September of 2014. In fact, my cousin specifically told my parents that they could not let me move to Alaska, and if they did, they'd have to buy me helicopter insurance, because I'd have to be medevaced out of the state at some point. Now, I thought that was a bit harsh, but I could understand where they were coming from, because at that point in time, I'd had Crohn's disease for about 7 years, and 4 major abdominal surgeries in that 7 years. But I was determined to go anyway, and after finding a job, finding a roommate on Craigslist, and getting on the plane, I made it to Alaska. I stepped off the plane without ever having been in the state and without knowing a single person, and being the socially reserved person that I am, I knew I had to come up with a plan to make some friends. So I joined a hiking meetup group and went on a couple of hikes throughout the month of September. And then in the first weekend in October, I decided to branch out a little bit further and go on a hike out of the Anchorage area to Tyhacker Mountain just out of Seward. So I joined the meetup group at Cars on Huffman, and we planned our group to ride down to the trailhead with, and I ended up in a car full of pretty experienced hikers, and I was really excited to learn from them and learn about hikes in the area. And everything was going really well until we reached Turnagain Pass. And at that point in time, my stomach really started to hurt a lot. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm just nervous. I've never met these people before. I haven't gone on hikes with them, and I don't really know the area that well. I'm sure it'll be fine once I get out on the trail and get going. So we make it to the parking area, and my stomach continues to hurt. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go check out this situation. And this is where I should explain that one of my surgeries for my Crohn's disease was to create an ostomy. And for anyone who doesn't know, an ostomy is where they take your intestine through your abdominal wall, and there's a small piece that sticks out called the stoma, and then I wear an ostomy bag over that. And that's what I poop into pretty much every day. And so I went into the woods while everyone else was going to the bathroom, getting their gear together and to get out on the trail, and I went to check out my ostomy. So I open the bag and go to empty it, and blood just comes pouring out. And I'm like, ooh, well, that's not good, but maybe it's just a Crohn's flare. That happens. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'll go see a doctor this week and get it checked out. And so I close up the bag, head back to the parking lot to meet up the group. And the hike's going pretty well. I'm a little concentrated on the pain, but I'm like, okay, it might still be nerves and everything. So I'm having fun getting to know everybody and chatting about the hike ahead. And we get about a mile out on the trail, and the pain just becomes unbearable. I kind of dropped to the back of the pack and wasn't talking to anybody anymore and was just really thinking, like, okay, I have to come up with a new plan. I can't go up that mountain. But I also don't want to ruin anybody else's hike because I don't even know these people and I don't want them to feel bad for me or anything. So I pull two of my carpool mates aside and I'm like, hey, I have Crohn's disease. I think I'm having a flare, but it's going to be fine. It's not really a big deal. So I just need to go get it checked out. And they're like, okay, what do you want us to do? And I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'll just head back and have my roommate come get me. And they're like, no, I think we should drive you somewhere. And I'm like, no, it's okay. And so they're like, well, okay, well, why don't you get on the phone with your roommate and see what she says? So I get on the phone, try to call her, but service isn't that great out on the trail. And so I text her, and she texts me back, and she goes, okay, I can come get you in probably 2 hours and 30 minutes. And I'm like, perfect. I'll just go wait at the car for 2 hours. It's fine. She'll be there really quickly. And so they look at me, and they're like, I don't know that that's a good plan. To be in the middle of nowhere while you're having a medical issue in a town that you don't even know. And I'm like, yeah, I can see your point. And so one of them's like, well, how about this? I'll give you my car keys and you can go to the hospital in Seward and get checked out. And after the hike, I'll come get my car and we'll go back to Anchorage. And I'm like, all right, that sounds like a better plan. I like that idea. So I head off in the opposite direction of them. And as I get out of sight, I start running, because at this point, I really have to get out of the woods. I know something's not right, and I have to get to that hospital. So I get to the truck, which is the largest vehicle I've ever driven. I punch in the directions to Seward, where I've never been. I drive down the road, and I make it to the hospital. And the parking lot's pretty empty, and I've never been there before, so I kind of have to wander around the building to find the entrance. I make it into the waiting room, and I say, I have Crohn's, and I have an ostomy, and there's a lot of blood, and I need to be seen immediately. And because it's Seward on a Sunday, I'm the only person in the waiting room, so they take me back immediately. And the doctor comes in, and she's like, okay, why don't you take off your ostomy bag, and we'll see what's going on. I'm like, okay. So I peel off the ostomy bag, and there's just this giant black blob of intestine hanging out on the outside of my abdomen. And I look at her, and she looks at me, and I can tell she has no idea what she's looking at. And I'm starting to panic a little bit. And so I'm like, let me call my surgeon in Boston. He'll know what to do. And she's like, okay, that's a good idea. And so I get on the phone with him. And I try to call him, but he doesn't answer because it's late on the East Coast. And so I text him a picture of this giant black blob. And he calls back immediately and wants to talk to the doctor in Seward. So she chats with him for a little bit, and she hangs up, and she's like, okay, we have to get some sugar. And I'm like, sugar? And she's like, yeah, sugar reduces swelling. I'm like, okay, I've never heard of that technique before, but sure, that's fine. And so she goes into the waiting room and grabs sugar packets off of the coffee cart, and we just start dumping it all over my stoma and my abdomen. And she's like, okay, let's see what happens. And so we wait. And nothing happens. And I'm like, let's come up with a better plan. I think I'm going to call my surgeon again. And she's like, okay. So I get back on the phone, call my surgeon. At this point in time, he's already talked to doctors in Anchorage and the surgeons in Anchorage, and they've come up with a plan to medevac me from Seward to Anchorage. So they call for a helicopter, but the helicopter can't make it because weather is too bad in Turnagain Pass. So they call for an airplane from Fairbanks. So I wait in the room for the airplane to come. And while I'm waiting, I hear one of the carpool guy who I had borrowed his truck come into the waiting room and asking how I'm doing. And of course, they can't tell him anything about me because I don't even know him. And so he takes his keys and takes his truck with all of my stuff in it and drives back to Anchorage, I'm assuming. And so finally the airplane comes and they fly me up to Anchorage. We take the ambulance over to Providence, and there's my roommate of the past 3 weeks looking at me like she has no idea what she got herself into by selecting me as her Craigslist roommate. And so as I'm being wheeled back to the operating room after the surgeon has explained that my intestine was dead and that they needed to remove that dead piece immediately so that it wouldn't continue to die, and I'm like, yeah, I kind of knew that. It seemed dead. It's just been hanging out here all day. And so I'd already had 4 surgeries in the past 7 years, and I kind of knew what to expect. And so as they're wheeling me back for surgery, which turned out well, as I'm here today, I couldn't stop thinking about my family, the hikers that I had left out on the trail that had no idea what happened to me, the fact that I probably didn't need the helicopter insurance, but I could have used some airplane insurance, and that I couldn't wait to get back out on the trail again. Thanks.
That was Charlotte Foley. You were listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme tonight is Beg, Borrow, or Steal, stories of moxie, ingenuity, and desperation.
There's another theme that has emerged from this collection of stories, and that's family. And family is at the heart of our final story. From the Discovery Theater at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, this is Bill Popp.
So 7 years ago, I got into one of those silly arguments that couples get into. My wife was trying to help me out because I'm bad at birthdays, and she was trying to remind me that my mom's birthday was coming up and she was going to be 75. And I wasn't having it. So she went over to her laptop to prove to me that mom was going to turn 75. And the next thing I know, she's standing in front of me, having Googled my mom's name. And on the screen, she's saying, look at this. It's an adoption.com search page for a birth mother looking for a child given up at birth 50 years ago, 2 years younger than me, and it's my mom. Now, this just blows up my world because my reality is that my mom was a single parent, my mom, and she met my dad when I was 6, and they got married, and he adopted me at 10, and my brother was 10 years younger than I am, and my sister was 12 years younger than I am. That was our family. There was never a hint of this. And so, long story short, it was true. And so we had to have the conversation with my mom. And so we met, and my mom and my dad and my brother and my sister and I, and we helped her power through a story that just kind of turned our world on its head. So when she was 7 months pregnant with me, I was born at 7 months, 2 months premature, a victim of domestic abuse. My father was an alcoholic, a bum, and we were better off without him, was what my mom always told me. We didn't know anything more about him. She wouldn't share. And so she started to lay out this story that when she was divorced, not long after, that was a blemish on my family's reputation, my grandparents' reputation, who were well-to-do ranchers, societally very high up in Wyoming society. And here she is, single mother, divorced, and this was just not acceptable. And they put a lot of pressure on her. About a year later in the summer of 1960, my biological father came back into her life and said, hey, I'm sober, let's get back together. Come on, you know you want to do it. And she thought, well, my son needs a father and this would solve my problem with my parents, so let's give it a try. And so things went okay for a while and one thing led to another and she got pregnant and he was gone. So now she's a divorced mother and pregnant out of wedlock. And my grandparents came down on her like the wrath of God. You will help give this baby up in a quiet adoption or we will sue and we will have you declared an unfit mother and we will take both kids. So there she is. She knows me. She doesn't know this baby. And so she agrees to the adoption. And so she's telling us this story, and it's breaking my heart because this is a betrayal. My grandparents were the foundation of my life in many ways. I am who I am today because of my grandfather and my grandmother. He was bigger than life, riding a big buckskin horse, taught me to ride, taught me to drive a truck. My grandmother was this serene, quiet, wonderful woman who I just worshiped. And to find this out just basically tore my world down. But what was more important was what was going on with my mom, 75 and in frail health. So I looked at her and I said, Mom, what do you want to do? And she looked at us and she said, I'd like to meet her at least once before I die. And I said, Mom, I'm on it. So I started digging into this. And in Wyoming, they have a confidential intermediary program where an attorney gets appointed with special powers to go into Social Security records, IRS records, and are able to try and track down kids given up for adoption or lost parents, the whole nine yards. So we got that done, and in May of 2011, that got going. Summer went by, really didn't kind of lost track of it, really wasn't thinking that we were going to find her after a half a century. And in September, I get a phone call while I'm at work, and it's my mom. Bill, we found her. Her name is Brandy. She has two kids and a grandson, and she wants to meet us. I don't remember much for a few moments there because I was crying so damn hard. it really just blew me away because I thought, she's probably not going to want to meet us, might hate us, might not want to blow up her life by having this bunch of strangers come blowing in, but she wanted to meet us. So a bunch of phone calls and conversations later, I flew her up in October that year. And when she came out of that exit gate at Anchorage International, it was like a younger version of my mom walking through the gate. It just, they were just, this, she was us. And all the hugs went around and I kind of held back and then we hugged and we held on really hard. And I asked her, where have you been? And she said, looking for you. And so the next day, you know, well, we were, you know, the whole family's around and it's like, it's Brandy, she's back. Because she just fit right in. If you ever hear the argument about an environment versus genetics, let me tell you, this was just the most amazing thing. And so later that day, we're going through photo albums, because what else are you gonna do? You gotta try and tell the story of 50 years. And we get to the photos of my wedding to my wife, Nicole, in 1979, and our grandparents were there. And we get to that photo, and she just stops, and she looks at me, and she says, I've met them. When she was a 14-year-old girl in Casper, Wyoming, she went with a friend to spend the summer at her friend's dad's house, and the first thing they did was help set up for a party for a well-respected couple in the local community of Buffalo, Wyoming. 3,602 people, always has been, always will be. And they were going to have this big barbecue to honor them for their 50th anniversary. And here comes the guests of honor, and they come through and they start to do the introductions, and my grandmother reaches out to shake Brandy's hand and pulls back, turns white, and turns away and walks off. My grandfather, not knowing what's going on, reaches up, actually shakes her hand, then pulls his hand back, steps back, turns away, walks off. They left the party 15 minutes later. They knew it was her. They knew it because when Brandy showed me a photo of her at 14, she was my mother. Here's the fun part. 2 weeks later, my family showed up in Buffalo, Wyoming to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of my grandparents. And for 2 weeks, we were a mile and a half away from Brandy, and they never told us. Never told us. So, you know, what do you do with all that? How do you take that? You know, foundations torn out from under you, the arc of your life changed completely by decisions that were never in your control. What would my life have been with my kid sister 2 years younger than me? I don't know. But I do know that I've found her and that I hold her close as much as I can. We spent a whole whopping month and a half in each other's presence. And we do a lot of phone calls, and we talk. And I'll leave you with this. We decided we needed to tell our story, but before we did, we needed to figure out who our dad was, our biological father. And so Brandy and I started searching, and she found his obituary. He had died in 2003. And the obituary mentioned that he did have a son, but his name wasn't Bill. It was Patrick.
That was a story from Bill Popp. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell your own story live on stage.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. This spring, it is Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services. Information about this is also on our website.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This show was edited at the Alaska Teen Media Institute. I'm Kendall Stormo.
And I'm John Kendall.
Again, no relation.
Thanks for listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, and we look forward to hearing your stories. I love the stars.